It's like,
yeah, but I mean, what a better guy to tell it.
All right, well, I just wanted to show you another book that I thought was very formative of my thinking. It's called Michael Denton's Evolution, A Theory in Crisis. He's a microbiologist, this guy, Michael Denton, and he went to study evolution from genes, from the standpoint of genetics. And he goes into this book, he went and studied out Louis Agassiz and Cuvier and those sort of anti-evolutionist naturalists back in the days of Darwin, and they were criticized because they thought that they had an objection to Darwinism because of religious reasons. And he goes back and shows that it wasn't religious reasons, it was scientific reasons that they objected to Darwinism, and all of their objections are borne out. And basically the idea of this is that what we have in what's called the Great Chain of Being is classification. It's a series of classifications. And we all know about the classifications. It's what we name things, you know. You got the phyla, you got the kingdom, you got the phyla, you got the genera, and you got the family, and you got the species, and all of these different levels, and that's how they're classified. And he shows that they do not form a line. They don't form a chain of being, actually. They are divided up into typology. And the reason why I bring that out is because, you know, we have to deal with the issue of evolution in the sense that the way Darwin proposed it and then what he predicted would be found because of it, and everything has been proven false. Everything's gone the other direction. And yet the theory never dies. And the reason why the theory never dies is because it's not based on science. It's based on a philosophy of how things must be. And the philosophy is the idea of progress. The idea of natural, unaided, mindless progress, that things just get better. Except that goes against the second law of thermodynamics, that everything just gets worse. Nothing gets better. Nothing gets more ordered. Nothing gets more complex. Nothing gets more intelligent. Everything goes from high order to low order. That's entropy. That's what everything does. But the philosophy is that when it comes to living things, it went from chaos and no information to incredible amount of information and much order, and it kept on increasing. And so this whole concept existed long before Darwin, just to reiterate that point. Darwin did not invent evolution. The idea of evolution existed. His grandfather, 100 years before Darwin, had his own theory of evolution. The idea of evolution is that things just progress. Things have just, little at a time, small steps, things have gotten better until they are like they are now. There was a fellow named Lamarck. He was a Frenchman who had this idea of what they call acquired characteristics. Acquired characteristics is the idea that if you repeat a certain habit, something you're doing, well, then your children will be born with a propensity toward that habit. That's the idea. Like if the giraffe is constantly stretching its neck to get to leaves because it really likes the way leaves taste rather than grass, well, the offspring of the giraffe will be born with longer necks. And then those will keep doing that until finally you got a giraffe with a 20-foot, you know, high head. And, you know, and that's the idea of evolution from long before Darwin. Even before that, you can trace the idea of evolution back all the way back to the Greeks and to most ancient peoples that believed in a natural spontaneous generation thing. They would believe, for example, that just living things just were produced from non-living things by the nature, the force of nature itself. In other words, they would see a dog pile, and after a little while it'll have maggots in it. And they would just assume that, you know, it just produced maggots. It's like They called it spontaneous generation. They believed this way back in the days of Plato and Socrates and things like that. And it took a fellow named Louis Pasteur to disprove spontaneous generation. He went one by one and just disproved all of the cases that they would give, like the maggots one. He would prove that if you keep that dog pile, or whatever he was testing it on, I doubt it was a dog pile, but he was testing the theory, if you keep flies away from that fruit or from that pile, then no maggots are formed. And that maggots are actually the offspring of flies. And so he postulated, and he was a Christian, Louis Pasteur, and he postulated the idea that life comes from life, and it doesn't automatically get better. All of this is part of the evolutionary philosophy. The philosophy is that things just get better. And so they've applied this philosophy not just to living things, not just biological evolution. They believe it in the sense of solar systems. Solar systems evolve. They look at our solar system and they say, okay, then what must have happened was a whole bunch of gas, and then it all comes together, and then it becomes a sun, and the sun grows, and it blows up, and things start forming, and it's all swirling around. And they just assume that the solar system took billions of years to just form without any mind behind it, without any design behind it. And sure, if you just take a bunch of stuff and throw it out there with a bunch of rules that they have to obey, who knows what might just form? And you can look out there and see, you know, other stars with stuff circling around them. And so, yeah, it kind of makes sense. Except our solar system doesn't fit any scenario. It looks very much contrived. And that's the anthropic principle that I was talking about. And that is that there's too many variables that have to be exact for our planet to exist. So you look at something like our solar system. We have the Earth, and it's zipping around the sun, and it has to be within a certain distance from the Earth, from the sun. It can't be much closer than it is, and it can't be much farther away than it is, because it makes a difference in the amount of heat that it retains. The Earth has to be a certain size. A planet can't be as small as Mars, and it can't be as big as Saturn. It can't be, because those two things cause problems. If it's the size of Saturn, it attracts huge volumes of gas, so nothing can live on a surface. And if it's too as small as Mars, water can't survive on the surface. It just goes away. It evaporates, goes out into space. And so we're talking about extreme limits to what the size of the Earth can be. The Earth has to be, the orbit has to be relatively circular. It can't be too much elliptical. You can't be like Pluto or others that have really very eccentric orbits where it gets very close to the sun, then gets very far from the sun. If that happens, then, you know, no life can survive. No, nothing can exist. It has to be a certain size. It has to have certain types of elements. It has to have oxygen. It has to have carbon. It has to have a bunch of elements that are not found in all the planets. These things, there are hundreds of these parameters that have to be right for the Earth to work. But that's not all. The Earth has to have a huge planet nearby in a stable orbit so that it does not overly affect, and far enough away so that it does not overly affect the orbit of the Earth. And that what this huge planet is to suck up all the asteroids and comets that come in that would destroy another planet. Like, you get the planets that are outside of Jupiter, and they are just destroyed by comets and by other impacts. You get something like the moon that has been just beat up by all these impacts. But the Earth has hardly any impacts like that. We get once rarely, ever so often, but never a big one. And the reason why is because of Jupiter being so close to us, it just sucks all that stuff. Jupiter and Saturn, they suck up all, they're so huge planets that they suck it all up, which makes our life here possible. You just get all these things on, and you look at it and you realize this is not likely to be an accident. This is, if it is, it's the most fortuitous accident. And they've done all the parameters and done the calculations, and there are not enough stars in the sky to make it probable that one would exist. There are not enough stars in the sky. I'm talking about hundreds of billions of galaxies with hundreds of billions of stars in each one. There are not enough stars out there to make even one planet like the planet Earth probable. It becomes astronomically improbable that even the Earth would exist. Which makes you realize the theory of evolution, not biological necessarily, but just the idea that things get better by accident, was a theory long before Darwin. It's been proposed by people who didn't believe in creation since before Christ. And it came all the way up through, when it finally gets to Darwin, it had pretty much synchronized, what do you call it, crystallized. It had pretty much crystallized into a form of biological evolution, basically what they called acquired characteristics. That's when Darwin reads a guy named Malthus. And Malthus had this explanation of populations and how they morph. A single individual doesn't morph, but a population of individuals will morph. And it was a mathematical treatise, and he applied it to biology, and he came up with this theory called natural selection. And natural selection is very well understood, and it's absolutely true, and it is a marvel of nature. It is a tremendous thing. It's something God obviously devised to make species survive even in horrible, horrible situations. It also allows species to variate and go into and become other species. But the whole idea of evolution violates all kinds of premises. Now, first of all, I wanted to point out, and there's still more to say about the idea of the flood, but I want to get into this thing about evolution. I want to talk about the evidence for evolution. How many have heard of evidences that supposedly prove evolution? Y'all know of one? What's an evidence that proves evolution?
Well, things that I've heard mostly pertain with, like, a fossil record.
Okay, fossils. Actually, that's their biggest disproof. Fossils is a real problem for evolutionists. That was the idea, that fossils were going to prove evolution. That was the prediction Charles Darwin made. Fossils would prove his theory right. If his theory is right, he'd say, we're going to find innumerable transitional fossils. Okay. The truth is, I'm going to tell you that there are two basic lines of proofs for evolution. And one of them is called the chain of being, and the other one's called homology. You could have a third one that we could call microevolution, and I guess that is some sort of a proof in their idea. But the other proofs that they've had over the years, whether it's transitional fossils, embryology, vestigial organs, and transitional species, and all of those things, they've all fallen through. Here's the basic thing. The chain of being is the idea of science. We read what it says in the Bible. It says God created all these kinds of things. So what do we know? We know that God created a whole lot of different kinds of animals. We don't know how many he created. The kind of animals that he created does not correlate to our species that we see. The difference between a cat and a dog would be a difference of species. One is one species and others another species. They're very different. But we don't know but what God created a certain animal that could have turned into both cats and dogs, because we have seen species turn into other things. This is not the same thing as evolution. This is the idea of having a rich gene pool that speciates, that what they call, they narrow themselves down by getting rid of genes. That's what our genes are. We have fewer genes than our ancestors have. Everybody does, because because intermarriage and inbreeding, which is what everybody does, you marry something the most close to you. I mean, generally you have the similar cultures will marry together, and what that does is it reduces the amount of variability in a gene. So that in the days of Jacob and Esau, for example, twins could be born, and one was smooth and the other was hairy, and one was dark and the other was red-haired, and they're just extremely different. Or Jacob would take speckled sheep and put them together with other speckled sheep, and he would have them facing striped sticks and what have you, and it would produce more stripe. We have no idea how this thing worked, but it says that's what he did, and what it means is that things were much more likely to be very different. So you could have three sons of Noah turn into the three different main types of humans. They have the Caucasians and the Negroids and the you call it the Mongoloids. So that you have the three basic races. They call them races. That's not really races, but three types of humans. And the reason why is because in the original types, when God first created, the first examples were rich with all kinds of possible diversity. And as they get farther away from their original type, they keep on intermarrying with things that are more like them. If you take two small dogs and you mate them together, you're more likely to have a small dog. If you take two large dogs and mate them together, you're gonna likely to have a large dog. And the more you do it, year after year, generation after generation, you have a large dog that cannot produce a small dog. But at the beginning, a regular dog could have produced a large dog and a small dog. That's the theory. That's the idea of what the Bible teaches. And what the Bible teaches is extinction, not origination. You don't find in history origination of creatures. You don't find it anywhere. You don't find it in the transitional fossils or anything like that. You don't find origination of species or origination of animals. You do find extinction. There are many, many animals in the fossils that are extinct. You don't find them anymore. And we see extinctions happening today all the time. I mean, they just lost the last a lot of examples, the carrier pigeon, the dodo bird. They were there. They had a niche where they were living, and then they died. They died off. Why'd they die off? Well, they didn't fit into the next thing. Extinctions is part of history, but origination is not part of history. You don't find it anywhere. Anyway, I was wanting to point out the argument for evolution. And the biggest one at Darwin's idea is it's this chain of being. Now, there was a creationist book called The Great Chain of Being. And he was a naturalist classifying all the different kinds of animals. But if you'll start noticing these animals, you have all kinds of similarities. You have arthropods, you have mammals, you got these similarities. And then there's big gaps between these similarities. So you have, say, fish. And fish, they breathe with gills and what have you. But what kinds of fish are there? There's fish that have air bladders that allow them to float, and there's bottom dwellers like the sharks and what have you, or the catfish. And then you can divide these things up, you can classify them out. And when you get them all lined up, classified out, what you find is there's a similarity among a lot of these things that almost look like an increase in complexity or new ideas or what have you. The problem is that there are huge gaps between them. There's a huge gap between fish and amphibians. There's a huge gap between amphibians and reptiles. There's a huge gap between reptiles and mammals, or reptiles and birds. Huge gap. There's severe differences between these that are not bridged by anything in between. So the idea that you have this chain of being was the first, and it's still one of the main arguments in favor of evolution, and that is, look at all these animals that are similar. In fact, they will find a similar animal in the rocks, and they will say, see, there's a transitional form. It's in between. But what you find out is it's not. It's one of these other or the other. For example, the Archaeopteryx is supposedly the transitional form between reptiles and birds because it has feathers. But birds have feathers. That's not an origination. We already know. So Archaeopteryx is a bird, right? Oh, yeah, but it has teeth. But there are birds with teeth, not to existing today, but in the fossils you find lots of birds with teeth. If it can fly and it has feathers and it lays eggs and it has the empty bones, the hollow bones, and it is a bird. That's what we call it. It's not a transitional form. There's a huge separation between reptiles and birds. But the chain of being idea is that there is an unbroken chain all the way from the smallest animals all the way to the most complex, hugest animals, and that it's unbroken. That's the first evidence of evolution, and it's simply false. But there are tremendous similarities in those individual types. What we can divide them up into, they call it phyla. I believe there is 28 phyla. A fellow named Stephen J. Gould, he wrote a book called Wonderful Life. He went up to Canada to the Burgess Shale Formation and started studying some really strange fossils. And he started looking at all these strange fossils because everyone looking in the fossils is trying to find an animal that's found between these phyla, between these huge classification divisions. And what you want to find is an animal in between them. And so they saw some really strange animals up there. So he went up there to study it, studied it for years, and he wrote a book on it. And it's an amazing thing to me because they don't really realize what they found. But there used to be 28 phyla of animals, of fauna, what they call fauna. There used to be 28 phyla, and now there's 48 because he found 20 new phyla. He didn't find anything in between the phyla that we have. So instead of finding solutions to his problem, he found 20 more problems because there's nothing in between those and the other things. And you can read the book. I've got the book at the house. It's really a fascinating book, but it's not a creationist book. It's an evolutionist book that doesn't even realize that they complicated their own problem. We're not finding a chain of being between phyla. And we're not finding a chain of being between between genera. It's really hard to find. And we're talking about smaller and smaller classifications. But take something like mammals. You have mammals, which are a huge number of different kinds of mammals. And there's a lot of kinds of mammals. Mammals are a very wide-ranging. I mean, think about it. You've got the dogs, of course, and the cats, and the horses, and the mules, and the horses, and the cows, and the elephants, and the rhinoceroses, and hippopotamuses. Think about how different these animals are that we're thinking about. But then get into some weird ones like the armadillo and the platypus, and these are all mammals, but they are so different. You're talking about, you know, rats and squirrels, but you're also talking about bats. Think about how different mammals are. And where is the intermediate between, say, a rat and a bat? Where's the transitional fossil between a rat and a bat? And these are similar animals in the sense that they're both mammals. They both give live birth. They both suckle their young with milk. They both have hair. You see what I'm saying? But then take a platypus that also suckles its young with milk and that also has hair and also has, what's the other ones of mammals? What did I say?
Gives birth.
Gives live birth. Well, actually, the platypus, I think, lays an egg. And not only that, but the platypus has a duck bill. It's like a bird. And the platypus has poison glands where it can inject you with poison. It's like some of these reptiles. It's like a real mixed up thing, but it is a mammal. And the reason why this is important is because the argument in favor of evolution is the great chain of being. It's just all a little bit of change, a little bit of change. It's all these minute changes that can explain everything. The fact is, mammals, just as one example, is a huge family. And I don't know if it's a phyla or a family or what they call it. I'm not an expert on these things. But the idea is that this thing is so huge and that they're so different, and you can't even find transitional fossils in between those things, like a bat and a rat, or an armadillo and a anteater. Those things are extremely different. They will say, well, we can find transitional fossils from the Eohippus to the horse. Now, the Eohippus was a small little hippopotamus type looking little animal that they find in the rocks. Gone extinct. But then they find another Eohippus that's a little bigger. And then they find a proto-Eohippus something else that's a little bit bigger, whatever. And they arrange these things in an order so it looks like the Eohippus gradually became a horse. But if that's true, then what we're talking about is a very similar animal getting bigger and becoming the animal we know of today. This is not what we're talking about when we're talking about evolution. Evolution is not small changes going from an Eohippus to a horse. Or in other words, a small horse that looks a little bit like a hippopotamus and a large horse that we ride around now. This is not actual proof of evolution. This is not evidence for evolution. And if you actually study it out, that's a lie. That the horse evolution is a complete hoax. All of these animals are not in order. They are not in order. This one up here that's closest to the horse is found long in rocks a low way deeper than the Eohippus. It's all mixed up. It's false. It's false advertising, but they really do believe it. They believe it because it has to be. It's not because of the science demands it. They believe it has to be. There's a second one, and that's called homology. It's very similar to what I just said. But homology shows similarities in individual species. For example, we can go with mammals. The pentadactylar system, you have five digits on each hand, on each foot, right? And you can find those same five bones in bats. You can find those same five bones in horses. You can find this, they're there. The horse has a hoof, whatever. But the bones, the same bones that we have in our hands, are found in the horse's foot, and they're found in the bat's wings, and they're found in the dolphin's flippers, the same bones, or corresponding bones. They're the bones that correspond. This is called homology. If you look at all this, where does that come from? Why in the world would you have five bones in a flipper? You know, five sets of bones in a flipper that look like a hand if you just do an X-ray of it. Why would that exist like that? The argument is, well, they have a same ancestor. There's an ancestor in the back that had five bones, and and everything that has those five bones are, related. It's all related. That's probably the best argument for evolution, as far as I can, tell. Like, if we looked at twins, we'd say, you guys are related, aren't you? Because they look alike, right? And so if you look at a hippopotamus and a horse and you see some real similarities, you'd say, well, they must be related. Makes sense. Go ahead.
Couldn't you use that same argument for creation, though, that they all have the same desire?
Yeah, sure. Most cars look alike. They're very, very similar, but we don't believe they evolved. They don't have the same ancestor. They had creators that were following a similar plan, a working plan. And that's true. It's not really an argument, but it's their best evidence. Let's talk about a few other things. And I was wanting to get back into the idea of what the flood explained when it comes to... All right, another one that they had was called embryology. It was a big argument in favor of evolution from the time of Darwin on, and especially one of Darwin's followers called Haeckel. He wrote this huge book on embryology, and that's where they would look at the fetuses of babies, and they would say they're going through all the stages of their evolution. So whatever the evolution was you could follow the embryo as it's getting bigger. And so, like humans, when they're really, really small, they got these little folds in their neck, and they'd say, that's the gill stage. And, you know, they get a little bit farther, and they've got a, you know, a horn on their head or something, and that's the other. It has been completely disproven. It's completely false. That was one of the huge arguments that they had for a while. Vestigial organs was a big argument. They would come up and say, okay, look, the appendix has no use. The earlobes have no use. These came from our ancestors that, you know, we're gradually losing them because they're not being used or what have you. That's also been completely disproven, even by the most ardent evolutionists. It's just not true. There are no vestigial organs that can be traced back. Anyway. And then you have the transitional species that they do find. Like a couple of years after Darwin wrote, they found the Archaeopteryx. The Archaeopteryx is a early bird, what they call an early bird. It's a bird with a tail and teeth. Other than that, it's a bird. Now, there's other birds that they have found that also have tail and teeth. But they say, okay, this must be the transition between a reptile and a...
You mean like a tail, not like a normal bird?
Not a feather tail. Mm. It has an actual tail.
A lizard.
A tail with, like a lizard tail with feathers on it. You know, I don't really know. You look at they found like 15 of them now, whole fossils. So it was an actual bird that existed. The point is, there was no intermediate between the bird and the reptile. You don't find anything, but see, Archaeopteryx is a bird. It could fly. It had feathers. You know, it laid eggs. It had the fact that it had teeth and a tail just means it's a strange bird. It's just like a platypus has a duck bill. That's a strange mammal. We have to look at it. An armadillo has like a turtle shell. An accordion type turtle shell. It just like, it overlaps. That is a really strange animal, the armadillo, right here in Texas. You see them every so often. Strange things. Roll up in a ball and the wolf can't eat it. You know, it's amazing. But that doesn't in any way say that the armadillo came from shrimp or whatever else is similar to it. There are some other animals that have that same sort of a thing. The roly-polies in your grass, they have that same type of a shell. But we don't say that they're come from the same family. No, they're completely different. It just has the look of it. So the homology is a very flawed premise. It is their best argument that I've ever read. And in fact, the best treatise to encourage you to believe in evolution, I've read a bunch of books on evolution by evolutionists trying to convince me that it's true. And the most persuasive one is Charles Darwin's Origin of the Species. That is a persuasive, if you ever get a chance to read it, just read it. It is a very persuasive book. The fact that within 10 years it had been completely disproven by experts in all those fields, and now after 100 years, every single one of its predictions and every single one of its suggestions and hypotheses have all been disproven. The book is completely hogwash. It's not true. It never was scientific, but it's still the most persuasive argument in favor of evolution, and it's what still persuades people of evolution. It's interesting. Now, those are the ideas. Let me point out, I had it somewhere. Where was it? Let me just point out some things. What did I do with it?
Well, you dropped all your notes right before we started.
What did I do with it? Oh, here it is. All right. Okay, the evolution of evolution, Lamarckianism, Darwinism, Neo-Darwinism, punctuated equilibrium, panspermia, multiverse. Okay, just let me point out some of the things that have happened. Started off with Lamarckianism, and that was from the 1700s on, where it's called the theory of acquired characteristics. Then Darwin improved that by his, what he called the origin of species through natural selection. Natural selection, he's a genius to have discovered it, to have noticed it, and to explain how it works. His book is valuable as a scientific treatise just for his explanation of natural selection. Natural selection is a real phenomena in nature. It's happening all the time. It's been proven a million times. It is clear. You can see it happening in your own backyard. You can watch it happen. Natural selection is, and he actually showed it right after Darwin. They came up with this. They pointed out that the discovery of coal, the moths in London before the discovery of coal were white. It was full of white moths. When they discovered coal, within a few years, all the moths had turned black. The moths had turned black. And then when they got rid of coal, they stopped using coal-fired plants and all that, you know, steam engines, all that. They went to other types of cleaner energy. The moths turned white again. And you know why? The reason why is because the moths before coal, the houses weren't black, the trees weren't black. There wasn't this black soot everywhere. Everything was just normal, and the moths were white because it helped them to hide in among the lichen covered trees and the white buildings that are whatever. In London, it was painted white, and so all the moths were white because the birds didn't eat them. A white moth was more likely to survive before coal than a black moth. So if a black moth came out and a white moth, the bird would find the black moth and eat it, and so it would not have descendants. That's natural selection. So most moths were white. As soon as coal was discovered and all of these, you know, houses and stuff were covered with black soot, and London became a dark place for 150 years, it became a dark place during the Industrial Revolution. The moths had turned black because all the white ones were getting eaten. And that's just natural selection. This is normal stuff. It happens all the time. When they got rid of the coal, they turned back white because they had their advantage again. The fact that that is true, and it's a beautiful thing, doesn't say a thing at all about evolution. It doesn't say anything. Natural selection would be a process that would apply if you could originate something. In other words, if a fish in the ocean that has an air bladder that keeps it at the same height in the water so it doesn't sink and it doesn't float. This air bladder is automatic. It just keeps it always at the same height in the water. That air bladder, if it could turn into lungs, would give an advantage to that fish because then it could breathe in the air, right? But that natural selection would give the advantage. But that doesn't solve the problem of how do you make an air sac turn into a lung. It doesn't happen. It can't happen. It's not possible. An air sac is not a lung. There's nothing that would cause it to be a lung. You see what I'm saying? It's a complete design. The gills are a complete design for that fish, and a lung is a complete design for the mammal or for the reptile, the land-dwelling thing, in whose nostrils is the breath of life. These are complete designs that cannot be connected. And they all know they can't be connected. You can't connect them. They have no way of connecting them. All they can show you is how it could have worked if you could get the origination. Natural selection would have given them an advantage. And that's the entire theory of evolution right there. And it does not allow, it does not give you that possibility, the whatever it is. Anyway. Darwin came up with natural selection, which gave people the way to imagine how it could have happened. But it doesn't give you any answer as to how it happened. And then you had, that was disproven, by the way. It was completely disproven by the genetic theory. First found by a monk named Mendel, but his information got buried. And apparently somebody else read it and knew about and learned about it and then wrote his own book and didn't give credit. And so Mendel was only recently rediscovered. He's the one who came up with it, but it's the idea of genetic inheritance. And genetic inheritance means you have genes. They didn't know what they were. They didn't know about DNA, but you have genes. You have something in you that produces offspring of a certain way. And he narrowed it down to genetic traits, and you could trace them always to ancestors, proving that Things don't just evolve. Things don't just happen. They come from genetic material in the parents. That was Darwinism was disproved by Mendelian genetic studies. And so then they had to come up with what's called neo-Darwinism, which is the belief in random mutations. And that's the idea that at the molecular level, your DNA, your genes, before they even knew what DNA was, they knew that it would mutate. Sometimes something goes wrong in the copying of a cell, and it mutates. The cell mutates, and so it becomes a different kind of cell. And they would assume that certain number of the mutations would be beneficial. And it's true. There are a certain number of mutations that are beneficial. Nothing like what they need. But that the idea is that it would be. And that's the neo-Darwinian theory right now. But that has been basically proven that it's not adequate. You can't jump from a fish to an amphibian by random mutations. It's just not feasible. Fred Hoyle did his studies on mathematical probabilities and came up with it. It's just not possible. And he came up with what's called panspermia. He says, okay, since it's not possible for us to have evolved, he says, well, what must have happened was it evolved in basically the eternity past of the universe, and it was transmitted or transported to our Earth, either on purpose by some extraterrestrials or by accident, some comet hit us, whatever, and that's how it got here. Now we know that the universe is not eternal. it has a beginning, you know, because you can see that the stars are flying apart anyway. Then they come up with punctuated equilibrium. That was Jay Gould again, Stephen Jay Gould. He come up with this idea because he was the curator of some museum, and he was noticing that there's just not any transitional fossils. We're finding millions of fossils. We have so many fossils, we can't display them all. We can't even catalog them all. There's so many fossils, but there aren't any transitional ones. There's not an unbroken line of transitional forms from one thing to another. They're always punctuated. They're always separate. So he came up with the idea of punctuated equilibrium, meaning, another person explained it as the hopeful monster theory, meaning that you have a litter of dogs, and one of them, you know, looks like a platypus. It's like all of a sudden it just happens. And of course, that's really a stupid theory. It was stupid when they first said it, because you'd have had to have two, one male and one female, for it to go on, you know, for it to survive. It has to be a hopeful monster, a monster that can survive and replicate itself. It was a stupid thing. And then, you know, that punctuated equilibrium is basically where they are now. Most evolutionists don't believe it, but they don't have any other answers. Evolution of evolution, it's still evolving. They do not have answers to these things. They know it's true because it's their philosophy. It's their God. That's what they believe. That's their religion. They believe it has to be true. And their best argument against creationists that does not believe in evolution is mockery. That's their best argument. They just mock us because we're Hicks and we just don't believe the science. And the truth is, it's been disproven at every instance. It's the biggest hoax that has ever hit the earth. It's the biggest hoax. Furthermore, it's caused tremendous damage. Just like the preachers were saying back in the day, if you take away God out of the creation and then you teach your kids that you're just descended from monkeys, if you do that, people are going to become, you know, horrible people. And boy, did it happen. You've heard of the social Darwinism. You've heard of the eugenics movement. You've heard, like, Margaret Sanger, who wanted to get rid of, you know, the minorities and the lesser races. She wanted to get rid of black people. Why? Because, well, they weren't quite as evolved as us white people. That was her idea. And this is not... What?
I'm sorry, she wanted...
Yeah, she invented the abortion clinics and put them in minority neighborhoods to get rid of black people.
And other,
not just blacks, but Chinese, and she didn't really like Jews either. So So, but this all comes from the idea of Darwinism, this philosophy of Darwinism. Hitler, his philosophy was Darwinism. Stalin and Lenin, their philosophy was Darwinism. This was their idol. This was their religion. This was their God. It's the survival of the fittest. Why do you think he thought the Aryan nation was the one that was destined to survive? And it was absolutely justified for him to kill off all the lesser people. That comes from Darwin's survival of the fittest. The idea is that it's what's best for humanity. We kill off all the less desirables. And the nicer ones of all that ilk were the ones that just wanted to sterilize all the undesirables. So they would sterilize the minorities and the non-exalted races. And this started even Darwin. In fact, the title of Darwin's Origin of the Species is the favorable selection of the something selection of the favorable races. It's a racist book. And that is really what caused racism in itself. Racism didn't exist like we know it now before Darwin. It happened since him in that it became an idea that some people are superior to other people. The concept of that comes from Darwinism, or if not Darwinism, from the concept of evolution, because they did believe in evolution before Darwin. Anyway. Okay, there's some real problems, though. I'm going to point out a few problems. The first problem with Darwinism is abiogenesis. What they used to call spontaneous generation, now they call abiogenesis. Spontaneous generation was the belief that animals just happen. They just, like, the earth itself brings them forth. And that's what the Bible actually says. Let the earth bring forth stuff, you know. So their idea was the earth just, you know, produces maggots. The earth, you know, mice, you know, come from rice fields, and they just pop out of there. And of course, it was total bogus nonsense. Most good scientists knew it wasn't true, but it took Louis Pasteur in the 20th century to disprove it, and he did disprove it. So now it's completely discredited, the idea of spontaneous generation, that animals can just happen. So they now call it abiogenesis, that is, the beginning of life from non-life. That's what that word means from the Greek, abiogenesis. No life, life starting from no life, Genesis. The beginning of life from non-life. Anyway, abiogenesis is the idea that a very simple cell first happened. And it has to be really, really simple. But they've done the studies. They've done studies. Russian scientists have done the studies. American scientists, English scientists have done the studies. They've tried to figure out what is the smallest possible workable living cell. And by the way, all biological life is cellular. There's no other kind. It all has a cell. The cell is the simplest, smallest unit of life. And you've got these one-celled animals that protozoa, they're very small. You've got a couple of kinds of cells. Some are bigger and more complicated, some are simpler. These protozoan cells, these very small, amoeba-type cells, these things, the simplest possible one, they estimate, well, one guy estimated it had to be 500,000 to 600,000 gene pairs. DNA digits, 500,000. Another one got it down to what he thinks 250,000. But here's the problem. Do the math. 250,000 cells have to happen immediately. And they got to be in order, and they got to make it work, and it's got to survive. What are the chances? It is not possible. There aren't enough seconds in the universe's history, nor enough molecules multiplied times each other. There's not enough. It's not even close. It's not even in the running. You're talking about a number with 150 zeros after it. It's not like this. It's just not even feasible. Anybody who talks about abiogenesis as if it's a serious subject. They are just deceiving themselves. You guys remember back in the 90s? It might have been the year 2000, 2001 or something like that. I can't remember exactly what happened. What? You remember back in the 90s, Jackson? Anyway. Well, some of you guys might remember it. They came out with Life Was Found on Mars. It was in all the headlines. It was the leading story on you know, the CNNs and the news cycle. It was huge. Life was found on Mars because they got a meteorite, which they assumed came from Mars, and this meteorite had fossilized cells, fossilized microbes. Oh, it was a huge thing. And I was doing a study it had to be in the late 90s, not was in the 2000s, because it was in, when I was in Irapuato, and I was doing these studies on creation back in those days. Anyway, because they came out with it, they brought me the newspaper, look, it says life on Mars, life on Mars. They found evidence of life on Mars. And, of course, I just kind of laughed about it at the time, because the whole reason why they're looking for life on Mars is because they think it can just happen accidentally. They think just anywhere there's a place, life can just go, boop, there it is. That's the idea. It's the super poof theory. Poof, there you go. You got your first, simplest cell. And then that cell, replicates, and then it variates, and it just grows until there's a bunch of people walking around. That's the idea of evolution. Abiogenesis is an impossibility. It has to be designed. There's many proofs. Remember, we talked about it on the first study of this. One of the proofs of creation is language. You have to have a source and a target. And DNA is a language. DNA is a language that has specific instructions telling proteins how to form and what they're supposed to do. That's the DNA instructions. That's a language. Has to have a source and a target. The source, of course, is the mind of God, and the target is the creation itself. All right. Acquired characteristic has been disproven. Darwin's gemmules have been disproven. There is no method of evolution. There's nothing that causes an improvement in organs. There's nothing that originates new organs. How about the animals before there were teeth? How did they all of a sudden start having teeth? How do you originate teeth? They have no method that they can show. There's no method for developing an eye. You're an animal with no eye? Well, how do you come up with an eye? An eye is an extremely complex thing. Be able to recognize light, whatever. Well, they say one cell just got the ability to notice light. Okay, so one cell gets the ability to notice light. Accidentally, just pure random mutations, it all of a sudden now notices light. How does that turn into an eye? There are no methods. There's no explanation. None of them will ever explain any of it. Or not even give you a hypothesis how it could have happened. They just know it happened. That's all it is. All right, transitional forms have proven it. Every time they find new forms, it makes their problem harder. Just like when gold found those 20 new phyla. We're not talking about new species. We're talking about new phyla. Animals so different than any other animal that they can't even be classified in the same phyla. Like a phyla like arthropods. Arthropods includes lobsters and scorpions and insects. And this is a huge... That's what a phyla is. The arthropods means they have jointed exoskeleton, whatever. They all look the same. A lobster and a scorpion. They look very similar. Why? They have these, the way they walk and all that stuff. That's a phyla. They found 20 new phyla trying to find transitional forms. And there are none. This is a huge problem. And, of course, the genetic anomalies like the platypus and the pangolin and the marsupial wolf. Have you considered that? There is a wolf in Australia that is marsupial. Marsupial means it has the pouch like a kangaroo. But it's a wolf, just like our wolf. It's a wolf over there in Australia, but it has a pouch like a kangaroo. Now, how did, you just have to ask yourself, where does that come from? And they don't have an answer. There's nobody going to explain to you how the wolf evolved partly becomes marsupial and partly, you know, obviously you have to say that homology tells you all marsupials came from an ancestor marsupial, which we have no idea how it originated, but the first marsupial had to be the parent of all the marsupials, including the possums, including the kangaroos, and including the marsupial wolf. But the other mammals came from things that were not marsupials, and on those two lines, poof, we got a marsupial wolf and a regular wolf. Put them together, they just look like wolves. They're just two wild dogs is what they are, but one's a marsupial and one's not. And these kind of problems number in the thousands. They just gloss over them because there's no answer, but there are thousands of these kinds of problems. They say genetic evolution, the proof of the genetic evolution, and that is that chimpanzees have 98% the same DNA that humans have. Now, the reason why they can say that is because they discount all the different DNA. All they do is count the similar DNA, and all the different DNA, they consider that junk DNA. So they just take the similar DNA and say, okay, chimps have 98% the same as humans. And that proves what? That proves that humans, our closest relatives, are the chimps. Except pigs have 99% closest to us. So our closest relative is really the pig. This book is full.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it does make a lot of sense. Yeah. Another one is independent development. Mammals fly, insects fly, birds fly, reptiles fly, but they did not come from the same animal. They didn't come from the same. They know that they're completely different. They developed flight according to the idea of evolution. They developed the ability to fly separately four different ways, four different times. That's a real sticker for them. That's a real hard one. Sight. Octopuses can see, and arthropods can see, and mammals can see, and you know, all the different ways that there are the sight. All so many different animals have sight, and they didn't get their sight from the same. It's a strange thing that they have a complete different kind of sight. Like have you ever seen the eye on a snail? Well, that's a completely different kind of eye and a kind. Have you ever seen the eye on a fly? Completely different kind of sight than we have. All of these sight, the ability to see, these incredibly complex cameras could not have been developed from each other. They had to be developed separately, independently. Then you have the symbiotic relationships. The big one you all know about. Plants can't live without animals, and animals can't live without plants. That means they had to have come together at the same time. You can't have... It's a real problem for evolution. Now they're suspecting that evolution must have started in the bottom of the ocean. They used to have the primordial soup, you know. It was like a marshy place, and lightning struck it, and there was a little mud there, and it started the first little protozoa, and that became all of us, right? Well, there's a real problem with that. You can't have a marsh in the prebiotic world. Before there was life, there's no marshes. You can't even have the regular freshwater cycle. All of these things are symbiotic. They are produced by each other. You can't have flowering plants without bees. And bees can't live without the plants. So they had to come together. These are all symbiotic relationships. They had to happen at the same time. And this becomes a huge problem for evolutionists, because there's no possibility to calculate how many symbiotic relationships there are. And there could not have been the level of oxygen necessary to create the first microbe, because oxygen comes from plants. You have to have the flora in order to produce the oxygen, in order to be able to have the, you know, what do you call it, protozoa. They have to have oxygen. Although they've found now some little microbes down at the bottom of the ocean near those volcanic vents and whatever that create their own oxygen out of the water. So that's where, now that's where we came from. The prebiotic soup is not there anymore. There's no marsh, there's no lightning. It's all down there in the... But you can see how it's a real problem for them. All right. The sexual division. This is almost universal. Even trees are divided in sexes. There's male trees and there's female trees. There's male corn and female corn. There's every animal is male and female. There's such a small handful of what they call hermaphrodite animals that don't have sexual division. And you've got the little single-celled animals that just divide, and that's how they replicate. But the sexual division, there is no possibility, there's no explanation how we go from asexual reproduction to sexual reproduction. And sexual reproduction is so complex, it had to have been designed. There are no theories. There are no scientific theories as to how it happened. There are a bunch of silly hypotheses that just gloss over the huge problems. Anybody who studies it knows it. How about going from single cell to multi-cell? You know what a single cell animal is. It's like an amoeba, a protozoa. You can see them in the microscope. They're flying around there with their little tails. You know, they're zipping around in there, and then they go bloop, and they turn into two of them. And, you know, we understand how the cells sort of divide up and create like that. These are single-celled animals. They're completely separate, independent, single-celled animals. But what happens when all these cells come together and create a huge organism like us? How do these cells know to cooperate like that? How do the cells turn into a multi-celled organism? Because every kind of animal, beyond single cell, every kind of animal, whether it's jellyfish or snails or crabs or every kind of animal, is a tremendous complex joining up of other cells. We have cells connected all. We're just a whole bunch of cells. And these cells are joined up and descend from each other, and they just... It's a tremendously complex thing. How does two cells separating out say, oh, let's stay together, and let's form this huge jellyfish or whatever it's forming? There is no evolutionary explanation for that. Okay. And this other one, origination is non-existent and extinction is abundant. Extinction is abundant. Going back to the concept of the flood, when we look at the flood, what we are believing is, and I believe it not just because the Bible says it, but because I see the evidence of it, but we believe that all of the animals that are alive today descended from original pairs that came off the ark 5,000 years ago. Now, how does that happen? How do we have, for example, do we believe that Noah took Chihuahuas and Great Danes on the ark with him? No, we believe all those dogs came from one original type of an animal. And if it was something that could have produced only dogs, maybe. Most of the scientists will say that what was taken on the ark was no more speciated, no more distinct than genera. And so you're looking at, you know, 30,000 species, 30,000 types of animals had to go on the ark. But the latest ones that I've heard, we're talking about maybe 5,000 animals went on the ark. 5,000 animals, including what turned into all the different stuff that's today. I mean, we're talking about something that turned into penguins, also turned into ostriches, also turned into, that's the idea that they're having now. And they're studying it out, trying to prove. There's some creationists that are really studying this out, trying to prove it. But that's what we suspect. These aren't originations. This is not evolution. This is not where animals get new forms. We're talking about they're losing complexity. Every animal, like for example, a penguin can't fly, right? They lost. Apparently, its ancestors could fly. Now, they say it took millions of years. We're saying it took 5,000. This is a huge problem for creationists. How do you prove it? How do you prove that all of the cats that exist in the world today came from a proto-cat at the start? Come off the ark. A cat. Not 25 different kinds of cats came off the ark. One cat kind came off the ark, and that turned into all the cats that we have now, including the cheetah with its backwards hip. All those cats come from the same cat. And we're saying that happened because of natural genetic variability built into that original type of animal. This is what we as creationists are expecting to find, because that's the only explanation. We know that this world was covered and everything had to die. And since then, look what's happened. It's tremendous. But what we see is extinction everywhere. Since it's happened, things have just gone extinct. Species go extinct every day. We're losing thousands of species every day. But they say, well, look at the insects. There's like 6 million insects, over 2 million described. They're just assuming that there's another 6 or 8 million out there that they haven't found yet, because they're finding them at a rate, thousands a day. They're finding new insects. The idea that all of these insects were created individually by God in the form that they are does not make sense. That God made millions of insects. What makes sense is God made an insect type that had enough variability within it that it multiplied into many different kinds of insects. The information was already inside the first animals. Now, our DNA, they say it's only like 3% working code. They think 97% of it's what they call junk DNA. It doesn't do anything. Why would God make any kind of an animal with 3% working code and 97% junk DNA? He didn't. Think about it. The originals were full of DNA, and they've just gradually eliminated. You know what happens when you speciate? When a population speciates, it loses information. It all goes away. So this information goes away. For example, how do I explain that? If you have, Larsa, you have two animals, they mate, and they have some children, and these offspring, two of them are white and two of them are black, right? Obviously, the parents had the genes that were necessary to produce black offspring and white offspring, right? And so then the two whites go off there, and they mate, and three of them are white and one of them is black. And over here, three of them are black and one of them is white. And so then just the white ones join together and the black ones join together. And after a while, they cannot have the other offspring anymore. And the reason why is because they've lost their genetic source. It gets bred out. It doesn't copy.
Wouldn't that be like a mule? You take a horse and a donkey, you come up with a mule, and yet a mule cannot breed.
I think that's the more complex issue, the reason why they can't breed. I think a donkey and a horse actually adds information to the DNA, because they're getting, when you crossbreed, the children have more information than the parents. The parents individually have separate information. When they crossbreed, they add to their gene pool. They have more genetic information than their parents do. It's when you breed, not crossbreed, but when you breed, what you're doing is you're inbreeding. You're taking the same characteristics and breeding them. And what you're doing is eliminating the variations. And that's what happens in your genes. The variations eliminate. They disappear. And so after generations of inbreeding, which is called selection. It's artificial selection. We do it with dogs. We do it with sheep. We do it with cows, Angus cows, you know, or Hereford. These are highly inbred things. So we do it with corn. They're inbreeding what they call hybrid corn. They're making sure it only gets a certain one. And what it does is it gets rid of all those variabilities. So a far down the line species has a lot less information than its ancestors did. And we can see that, just like I mentioned about Jacob and Esau. Jacob had genes, and his wife had genes in them that could produce a very hairy red person. And in the same litter, that's not the way to say it, but in the same birth, had this smooth guy. And they're completely different kinds of people, but they were twin brothers. The reason why is because originally what came off the ark had a very rich gene pool. They call it a gene pool. That's the source that your offspring can take stuff from. Because when you create offspring, you give them your DNA. And the original lines of DNA was full of information. But as you go down inbreeding out, you lose the information. White people can't produce black people. Why? We've lost that possibility. But we know we came from the same parents. Even evolutionists know that. We can prove we all came from the same parents. But it was a long time ago. And after you, but now when you join two, you got a white and a black, when they get together, the child has much more genetic information than the parents have separately. And if you keep on doing that, like they did with the Longhorn cattle, they just started breeding. Now Longhorn cattle they're just back to the old normal thing. They got all that. It's all been inbred. It's just all those wild cattle get together and, you know, produce the Longhorn. It's the original kind of cattle because it's gotten back all that information, and probably not all of it, but some of it. It makes a difference. That's how our creationist perspective is. We believe in an original rich gene pool that has variated and inbred or outbred. I don't know what they would call it. They're getting rid of information in order to produce the different types of animals that we have today. And I personally believe they'll find out, they'll figure it out eventually, what were the original kinds. Because you can reverse engineer, you can back trace it out and find out, you know, whether those original kinds that came off the ark were, you know, how many there were and what have you, because you get to a place where you can't bridge it. And if you can't bridge it, then that has to be a separate species that was on the ark. All right, I know that, you know, it's getting a little bit tedious. I know Deb's getting tedious. I'm sorry. She'll point that out. Yeah, it's getting a little tedious. All right. What's the questions? I just want you all to know that evolution is a hoax. The people now will insist that it is the scientific, but the only reason why it's scientific is because it refuses to consider a supernatural creator. That's what they consider science now. Science dismisses any supernatural creation type thing, and so that's their definition of science. But it's not. It's not scientific. It does not have any actual proofs. And whatever is taught, you know, they come out with these new, what do they call, transitional fossils. Now they keep finding them. You've heard of the Caterpinchus? That was the proto-whale. You heard of the Coelacanth? The Coelacanth was the original amphibian. The Pachycetus was the, it was the original. They have them all. There's hundreds of them. The Dimetrodon, a reptile with mammalian skull. The Tiktaalik, a fishibian. The Odontocheilus was a proto-turtle, a turtle without a shell. They find these things. This is all nonsense. They're trying to come up with something. They just believe it so much. They believe it so much. Like all these apes that they say are ancestors to humans. And the reason why is because their molars are a certain way, and because they're, you know, they look like they're walking upright and all that. And then 20 years later they find out it's not true. They didn't walk upright. They were knuckle walkers. They were apes. You can look at, you, I don't know if you've ever seen them. They'll put all the skulls together. You can see the division perfectly. All these proto, homo habilis, homo whatever. And then you have the human, the Neanderthals, whatever. And if you look at them, there's a tremendous difference. There's a clear division line. These are all apes. These are all humans. It's a clear line. Don't let them fool you into thinking that that they have actual evidence of evolution. They do not. And there are plenty of books to prove it. And when they do the debates, the evolutionists have stopped doing the debates because they lose the debates. There's just too many problems with their theory. I'd say that the best theory that we have right now is flood geology. It explains more things. There's some things that aren't explained, but it explains a whole lot more than evolution does. All right. Any questions?
What did they find on Mars again?
They found...
What did they find on Mars?
Did I lose that rabbit trail? I didn't finish it.
You were talking about a rock that they found that had a cell or something in it. But that rock was found here on Earth, right?
Found here on Earth. It was a meteorite. They assume it came from Mars because it had certain elements in it that they get from Mars. And it had fossils of microbes, fossils of little protozoa,
pretty amazing.
Little animals. But it turns out it was all false. But the fact that it was false didn't get put on the front page.
Right.
It never gets put on the front page. It was front page news that they had found life on Mars. But when they found out it was not true, it didn't get put anywhere.
Yeah, and that's like that Lucy's skeleton and then that pig's tooth. You know, they claimed it was
No, those were hoaxes. Like
yeah,
that.
Yeah. Some real hoaxes. That's what they're doing.
Lucy is a type of ape. It's an interesting type of ape, but it's clearly an ape. Lucy was an ape. It's a little bitty thing. But they thought it was an early ancestor of humans because they said she walked upright. The reason why they think she walked upright was because it had something in her bone or whatever. They've since disproved it. She was a knuckle-walking ape, just like all the others. She didn't walk upright. Another difference was the molars. Had something to do with how they grind, how they chew. But they've also found apes that do that. So it's like, these things are they're just grasping at straws. They really are. But here's the thing. They really do believe this. They're not trying to fool us. They think they are onto the truth, and they really do believe it. But they are blinded at their own lack of evidence. They just are so certain that they just skip right over the lack of evidence and just make assumptions. And all of it is assumptions. They skip over all of the important things that they ought to be explaining, and they don't ever explain it. Just explain single cell to multi-cell. Just explain non-sexual division to sexual division. There's no explanation. Nobody. They don't even have an explanation for the simple ones, like hand to paddle.
You went to the Ark, right, up in Kentucky?
I did, yeah.
Because I'm thinking about that. The way I remembered, a lot of the animals that they depicted in there, they looked more like dinosaurs than anything we have today, from what I remember.
People are fascinated with dinosaurs, and it's pretty fascinating because apparently before the flood, huge reptiles abounded. Mammals before the flood were high-dwelling, cold area-dwelling creatures, fairly small. They got put on the ark, and when they came off the ark, they speciated into what we know of now but after the flood, everything was colder. And so mammals were much more adapted. So reptiles died off. Reptiles die off in cold weather. Reptiles only live in the hot weather. They just can't handle the cold because they're cold-blooded. They're cold-blooded. And birds and mammals flourish in cold weather. And so that's why before the flood, it's nearly all reptilian. Most of the fossils are reptilian. Most of the fauna fossils are reptilian or fish. but very few are mammals. They're comparatively very few. Although all the mammal types are found in the fossils. They're all there. It's not like we have things now that aren't in the fossils. Right. No, they're all there. Oh, another point to be made is they find the differences in the animals, but they don't find differences in the tree, in the plants. What you find as fossil plants still exist today. It's interesting. It's very interesting that you got the certain kind of, like you find a leaf from the fossils, and it'll be a leaf just like the leaves we have today. It's almost like there's nothing gone extinct. There's nothing different than back in those days, all the same type of plants. It's very interesting. They don't have these extinctions, clear extinction events in the plants, which doesn't make sense. Doesn't even make sense from my point of view, creation point of view. I don't know why, why would the animals be so different? Because there are some real differences in the animals. A lot of those animals have gone extinct. A lot of those reptiles do not exist anymore.
That Dr. Carl Ball that had that has that Creation Evidence Museum up in Glendale, he had, was talking about that he believed that the earth before the flood was actually about 20% smaller than what it is today, and that you had a heavier atmosphere. And he was talking that was one of the reasons why back in those days snakes were not necessarily venomous. And if I remember right, they had a pressure vessel there that they had actually put a snake into, and by pressurizing it, it would turn non-venomous, if I remember that.
Well, that was at the one.
I've read creationists since the 70s. I have read so many of their books. And I gotta tell you, they come up with some whoppers. They have had some theories. And of course, you first had the canopy theory, and then you had the, and then now they have the hydroplate theory. And all of these are speculative theories.
Right.
They're just models trying to come up with how the flood happened. And as far as I'm concerned, that's a lot of speculation. I will not endorse any of that. I don't believe that the earth, like they'll say that the earth didn't used to be tilted, and during the flood it tilted, or none of this makes sense to me. I really do like these simple creationists, like the ICR or the Answers in Genesis. These people are just, they're real scientists really trying to come up with a rational understanding of how things happen. And they make a lot of good points. But the ones that are fringe, the more fringe ones, I'm very leery of. I think they make crazy statements. Like they'll say, we had a metallic dome made out of metal helium. Helium is a metal. Did you know that? When it's frozen, it's a metal. And what's this metal dome? What are you talking about? That's how we had so much more atmosphere in here. Come up with a better theory. Just don't talk. Now, there's been some real doozies.
But that is interesting about the plants. I can't stop thinking about that.
I just read about it today that says, wow, that plants, they don't have any kind of transitional fossils in plants. There's no...
Oak tree is an oak tree is an oak tree all the way back.
Billions of years. Same old oak tree.
Billions?
Whatever. Well, that's their theory. They have this oak tree from a billion years ago. That's what they're saying. That the trans. I was reading an evolutionist saying, okay, we don't have any any things with the plants. It's a really strange mystery to us that the plants haven't evolved. They were always the same. That's right. That's what I said at the very, I guess y'all were here. But the idea is that evolution is the concept of progress. Things get better or more complex and more detailed and more sophisticated as we go on. And the second law of thermodynamics is that everything is reduced. You get less order, less information, less complexity so, as we go on.
I think they walked in after that.
Really?
I think okay. So. 5 minutes.
Yeah, I mentioned it. That was just one of the points, though. But yes, thermodynamics.
So they would pretty much consider the birds flying in front of the door openers now at Lowe's and going in and roosting at night for safety and security and feeding and stuff. They would consider that a form of evolution because they're increasing.
They would call it evolution, but what that is natural selection. And natural selection is real and true.
Right.
Christians don't need to be criticizing natural selection.
Well,
that is a very real thing that is at work all the time. The problem is natural selection can only select what already exists. You can only choose which is best of two options that already exist. Natural selection doesn't make something exist. It can't create anything. But if there's two options, one of them will have an advantage, and that's the one that'll win. That's natural selection.
Like a monkey in a stick. He finds a stick, accidentally pokes it into a termite hole, and he's got dinner, and the next monkey next to him saw it, and keeps going. What we're talking about here?
Well, is there a difference between
natural selection
and adapting? I don't know what you're talking about.
Adapting is just...
Adapting, if you're talking about the population, you're talking
that
about
like
a whole group
adapting.
Of species yeah. is adapting.
Right.
But evolution is the idea that it originates something new. So that an animal that didn't used to have a lung now has a lung. Where did the lung come from? That's an origination idea. Natural selection can't originate anything. Natural selection can extinct something, but it can't originate anything. What exists can be acted upon by natural selection, but natural selection has no power to create something new. No, they really do believe that. They'll give you. You go onto the internet and you can find the evolution of the giraffe, and they'll give you the little animals that they. Of course, they all have the same number of bones. So what's evolved? Their bones got longer. The giraffe's neck, the shortest neck giraffe found in the fossils has the same number of bones as the longest neck giraffe today.
I heard they found evidence that the politicians in Washington are getting smarter and smarter.
I don't think there's any evidence of that.
I'll tell you that.
They're getting smarter?
Yeah. I'll tell you.
Boy, all you got to do is read some of the books from 200 years ago, and you'd say, we're getting dumber.
Yeah.
We are getting dumber. Yeah. I was reading this book that Joe Benedetti mentioned to me, written in 1930, called Who Moved the Stone? This is a Brit writing back in 1930. And man, is he sophisticated in his language. And I'm thinking, wow, how do they remember all these words? You know, it's just...
They have iPhones. They have a memory.
Yeah. I'm telling you, we're getting stupider. At least I am. I don't know.
We're just putting on computers to remember stuff.
Or that guy Anderson that knew fluently 20 languages, the guy that was part of the... King James translating, he knew 20 languages fluently or more than that. I don't know.
Oh my goodness.
What?
He had no Facebook page at all.
This is true. He was not playing Candy Crush Saga, I can tell you that.
I like Candy Crush.
Just phone numbers alone. I mean, used to back in the day when you dialed them, you remembered everybody's phone number.
Huh.
Now the only one I remember is the one I used to have years ago before we took it out.
Yeah.
Well, let's pray to dismiss this.
Bye, Lena.
Head out there, Lena. Lord, thank you for your gift of knowledge and the Bible to give us some light and guidance. And thank you for these men that have gone on before and braved the mockery and all the things that they've had to go through in order to be able to study these things out and give us knowledge that we would not be deceived. Thank you for them. And bless us in our plans. I ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Absolutely. Keeps turning.
Well, one governor is getting smarter in Montana. The governor of Montana is like cutting off.